Why is it so easy for children to break into the Pentagon?
You have to stop!
If I'm not mistaken, you're the one who bet that leprechauns weren't real. So why do you care what happens?
Because because I think they are real. It's all real. Think about it. Haven't Luke Skywalker and Santa Claus affected your lives more than most real people in this room? I mean, whether Jesus is real or not, he's had a bigger impact on the world than any of us have. And the same can be said for Bugs Bunny and Superman and Harry Potter. They've changed my life. Changed the way I act on the Earth. Doesn't that make them kind of real? They might be imaginary, but they're more important than most of us here. And they're all gonna be around long after we're dead. So in a way, those things are more realer than any of us.
I'm coming in good. How you sounding?
Sounds all right on my end.
Yeah, you're coming in well here too. Okay, sweet. We can get to it.
Well, again, I'm going to go back to this piece of kind of realizing my own queerness, partially through thinking about my relationship with media, because that has echoed back through some of what I'm creating.
Probably the most impactful thing that I took away from those characters was that, you know, you don't have to sort of watch the world go by. You can actually go out into the world and make a difference. I think that was probably the most uniquely impactful thing that I kind of, that changed my, the way I saw the world, right? Sometimes you sort of feel like there's all the stuff going on, it's just kind of coming at you. But then, you know, I think in those fictional stories, I kind of realized that maybe I do have some power to change things. I had some power to impact the way the world was turning out, or at least my own immediate circumstance. I could sort of approach it with a lot more confidence. I think that was a really important lesson to me, that I don't have to necessarily just kind of read and watch things happen. I can make decisions that would change my life and change the life of those around me.
All right. Power.
You.
Wilson.
Lou.
You are now listening to the Comicidal Podcast, and this is the power of you in fiction. What up, what up, what up, Comicidal fans? This is an exciting day because it is finally time. As some of you may know, Wilson and I have been putting together this Power of You in Fiction special, and we're excited to bring you the first episode that we've decided to entitle Why We Tell Stories.
Yeah, so we obviously realized that hitting a topic as nuanced as representation when it comes to literary fictional pieces and how that impacts real life individuals would be something that Lou nor I have a full academic expertise on. We're engineers by study and trade, and the whole unpacking philosophical and highly nuanced and complex systems thing when it comes to representation and social order, that's a hobby, we'll call it, you know, we'll call it a hobby. So we wanted to add some academic heft to the podcast journalism, I guess, aspect that we're using here.
Yep. So what we did was consult two very special subject matter experts.
Yeah, my name is Raymond Marr, and I'm an associate professor at York University in Toronto, Canada.
Now, Dr. Marr's research interests include the imagining of self in fictional situations, influence of fictional characters, an association between reading narrative fiction and social abilities, and the underlying mechanisms and real-world ramifications. So, what you might be wondering is, how somebody gets into researching this for a living?
I started off in forensics, actually, when I started my undergraduate education, and quickly found out that it wasn't for me. It was just too grim, just too depressing. But during that time, I did go to a conference on forensics and visited a lot of different sessions, and remember going to a bunch of sessions by forensic psychologists. And they were really, really funny. And so I decided to go into psychology, and I left forensics. I went into psychology and continued my undergraduate education, and didn't really have any inkling of pursuing graduate work necessarily or even on a particular topic until I got to my fourth year. And in my fourth year, I was finally freed up some room to take some electives, and I took a humanities course, the first ever humanities sort of English courses that I was able to take in university. And this course was all about rhetoric, which was about how various pieces of literature might be trying to make persuasive arguments. And it had never really occurred to me about that fictional literature could be trying to convince us of certain things or trying to convey certain ideas. And I'd always been, you know, a really, really avid reader growing up as a child. And it was just fascinating to me. And I thought that, you know, I wonder if it's possible to combine psychology and this interest in fiction. And I was really pleased to discover that, you know, this wasn't a totally new idea and that there were people working on this topic. And really one of the originators of research on this topic was Keith Oatley,
our other subject matter expert.
And I went on to do graduate work with Keith and get my PhD. And that's just sort of how it all started.
And so Keith Oatley's been doing this longer than I have been alive. And he was a fascinating guy to talk to.
I'm Keith Oatley. I'm an emeritus professor at the University of Toronto. I'm a psychologist and involved in what I think of as the psychology of fiction, trying to understand what both writers and readers do when they're engaging with fiction.
Keith was sort of marrying his first two loves, because he had a love of writing, and he had a love of
psychology.
Yes, that's why you're my co-host. Yeah.
Okay, I better take over from there. So I moved permanently to Toronto at the beginning of 1991, and although my main research until then had been on the psychology of emotions, I thought I was going to concentrate on what I said, the psychology of fiction. And part of the reason for that is, as well as being a psychologist, I'm also a novelist. So I wanted to put together those two bits of my life, writing novels and being a psychologist. And so I started doing experiments on this. And then, as Raymond said, he was one of two people. He and Maya Jikic both came and did a course with me. And really, our work has taken off from there. And I'm just delighted that Raymond continues to be here in Toronto so that we can continue to work together.
Well, they're both professors. They both focus on literature, fictional literature, in essence, how fictional representation creates abstractions for the real world and is used as a model for what we might experience in real life.
Yeah, and it's crazy how quick you got into that topic when we started interviewing them.
Wonderful. Awesome. So, As we were reading through your the research that we found, well, I guess the published works that we found, the first one that we found was the Function of Fiction, and I guess I wanted to get a little bit more comments on one of the statements that you all had, where it said narrative fiction models life's comments on life and helps us understand life in terms of how human intentions bear upon it. I was hoping that we could probably expound upon that thought there.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that narrative fiction is a really complex, maybe the most complex human cultural product that we have. It's certainly one of the most universal human cultural products. I mean, there's fictional storytelling throughout human history, across cultures, pretty much everywhere. And in my mind, the reason why it's so prevalent is because it mirrors our fundamental interest in other people. I think that humans, as intrinsically social animals, rely upon being able to understand and collaborate and cooperate with other humans. And that turns out to be really difficult because we can't look directly into the minds of other individuals. So we always have to make predictions. We have to make guesses. We have to make inferences about what other people are thinking and feeling, what they want, what they desire, what their goals are. If they're trying to deceive us or whether they're trying to help us, it's immensely complicated. And I think that much of our cognitive resources go towards trying to understand other people. And I think that that's probably the reason why we spend so much of our free time, so much of our leisure time, consuming and creating stories. I think this is why the stories are such valuable cultural products, because they do provide information about other people, which is the most important to us when it comes to sort of surviving and thriving.
And Dr. Oatley?
Yeah, I think that's right. So what we need to do in order to understand other people is we do what we psychologists call making mental models of those people. So people who are our friends, our loved ones, our relatives, we want to understand them. And so what we do is we construct a model of who this person is. And with that model, we can know what kinds of intentions this person has, what we can collaborate with them about, how to understand what they're saying when they are saying something that is ambiguous. And in most conversations, of course, we don't entirely know what the other person means. So you can say, oh, come again with that, or what did you really mean? But what we're doing is we're trying to create an understanding of other people. And as Raymond said, really what fiction is about is continuing that idea, but as it were, giving us extra ways of thinking about it so that we can actually become better at doing it. And so people think of fiction as just a sort of pastime, but it's actually much better than that. What it does is it enables us both to take part in and also get better at what's actually most fundamental to us as human beings, which is understanding each other.
And so just to we can expand a little bit more on the parallels to of story to STEM. So listen, wanna wrap to the listeners a little bit about what you do for a living and how experiments are sort of part of your everyday job life?
Oh yeah, so I am a lab coordinator for three undergraduate teaching labs at Howard University. That's where I apply my trade for the day-to-day 9-to-5, Monday through Friday grind. But in undergraduate teaching lab, what we're doing on lab days is taking the concept that the students have learned theoretically in class from their lectures and applying them in practice. So best example, for our mechanics and materials lab, or our structures lab, as other universities might call it, we'll essentially take everything to failure, which means we're breaking stuff. When we do a concrete fracture test, we'll apply X amount of load and we'll see how much, you know, force it takes for this concrete to fracture. And then we'll hit the readings and we'll see if that is analogous to the numbers that they've seen in theory from their textbook. So there's things like that, you know.
So I myself work as a structural engineer. So I work in the design of buildings, bridges type structures in regards to primarily steel and concrete, and how it rolls right over what Wilson does. So full disclosure, listeners, engineering isn't an exact science. We come up with a scenario, and a lot of our formulas are based off of the actions of materials in a perfect world and to take into account every bit of the world at any time we were designing, we'd never build a building because we would never know exactly what that building was going to encounter. And stories work not so differently.
No, I think that's right. But you see, what you're doing when you're a designer, and I've done a postdoctoral course in engineering, so I know some of what you're talking about. What you're doing is you're designing something for an environment that maybe you don't completely know about yet. And so you have a prototype, you run it, it doesn't quite work. And so there's an element of exploration in that as well. And I think as a designer, that will be both very familiar and very important to you. The exploratory idea. And so that's right at the heart of fiction.
I was just going to say that, you know, something else that Keith and I have written on that really does resonate with what you said is that fiction acts to abstract out and provide a mental simulation of social experience. You know, and so in some way it can take one particular element or one particular idea and really blow it out and elaborate upon it to allow it to be explored sort of more concretely, more in focus, but also maybe in more detail and nuance.
Listen, since we run experiments all the time, are you familiar with open and closed system experimentation?
We haven't tackled it directly in the labs since it's a junior, so we're doing junior level lab courses and they don't really get there. But I am, I guess, tangentially familiar.
Most lab experiments are closed system experiments. You're cutting down on your sample space and eliminating other things as factors so that you can hone in on a certain thing. Okay, bump that. I'm going to try this another way. Say that you wanted to know how fast you can run the 100 meter dash at your best. If you really wanted to run a good scientific experiment, you would try to eliminate any factors that can either aid or hinder your performance in this race outside of what's considered standard. So things like the wind, depending on the direction, will either work for or against you. If the track is wet because it recently rained, that'll work against you. You want to make sure you have a good set of starting blocks each time. So if you were to run scientific trials, you would try to make sure everything is ideal as possible, that you're hydrated every time you run the race, that you only run the race on an ideal temperature range on days when there's no wind. And then once you have all of that set up, you run the race over and over. And you'd be able to accumulate a good statistical average that would serve as your 100 meter time. The pulling away of all those factors is how closed system experimentation works, which is how story works.
That's a good analogy.
Appreciate it. I wanted to find something that wasn't too over your head, and my mind normally defaults to track because of my life.
I feel it. Yeah. It's like how Kool always does football analogies when he's talking about
exactly.
Breaking down film.
It's exactly like that. But this is the part where we're going commercial break, and when we get back, we're going to sort of shift gears and talk about how story affects the creator and how the stories affect us as consumers.
Ever been listening to the Comicidal podcast and wonder to yourself, these guys do great work. They've got a lot of good content, but why don't they have some music, a little bit of bells and whistles infused to the conversations? Answer to that is
Lou and I being Wilson, aren't the greatest producers. So this here is an open call to anyone who listens who might be a producer, or who may have a friend of a friend, a relative, an associate that is a producer and would be intrigued to hopping on board and helping the crew out with some production work, right? If you're interested, you can email us at podcast@comicidal.net. Email again is podcast@comicidal.net. We would love to hear from you. If you've got some suggestions for us to get better with this production thing, if you got some ideas to take us in directions that would be even more intriguing and exciting, email us podcast@comicidal.net.
Let me see if I can do this in my best movie phone announcer's voice. Just kidding, y'all. But on a more serious note, if you're an independent comics creator or small press and you'd like to expand your distribution to the Pacific Northwest, Emerald Comics Distro provides an accessible, affordable way to get your books in shops in the Puget Sound region. Visit EmeraldComicsDistro.com. So that's Emerald Comics Distro, EmeraldComicsDistro.com. Submit your work today. And Veen is an amazing person, fantastic individual, and we really love her mission here. So check it out if you'd like to expand your business.
Hey, Tom here. When I want a higher class of comics analysis, I listen to Comicidal Podcast, and you should too.
I've talked a lot about models. I began this talk with models, so let me end with some thoughts about model building. That's what we do as scientists. You know, when an architect builds a model, he or she is trying to show you a world in miniature. But when a scientist is building a model, he or she is trying to show you the world in metaphor. He or she is trying to create a new way of seeing. The former is a scale shift, and the latter is a perceptual shift.
And welcome back. You are listening to the Comicidal Podcast, and this is the Power of You in Fiction special, where today we are talking about the Great Story Experiment. Now, that clip you just heard was from a 2015 TED Talk by Siddhartha Mukherjee about the advancement of medicine. Now, while his TED Talk had nothing to do with the Great Story Experiment, that last quote was very interesting, right? Because I think a lot of people would think of architects and writers as closer to artists, and scientists and engineers as closer to technical. But scientists and storytellers are both working in models of perception of the world, and they're performing a perceptual shift when they world build or form their closed experience. And if you didn't realize that stories were showing you the world in metaphor, I'm not sure if you were really reading fiction correctly, because by definition, it's not real. So when you talk about reading story as a pure form of entertainment, I believe that is something that we should take a little bit more seriously as consumers, because we are doing the same thing that science does when we create stories, and we look to science to explain the world, and maybe we should be looking at fiction to explain something too. So we're going to get back into it with Drs. Marr and Oatley and see what else they had to say about stories and model building.
Okay.
Yeah, so sliding right off of that, I'm thinking what you said sort of sounds like a controlled environment and scientific experiment. So I'm a structural engineer, and for example, when we design structures, we come up with our empirical formulas by imagining a perfectly formed structure and vacuum where it doesn't actually exist, but you understanding how a structure would behave without influence of outside forces like heat or external strain. We can then sort of understand it to the point where we can design for it. And I feel like that's sort of what you were saying fiction is doing.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, something else that Keith and I have written on that really does resonate with what you said is that fiction acts to abstract out and provide a mental simulation of social experience. You know, and so in some way it can take one particular element or one particular idea and really blow it out and elaborate upon it to allow it to be explored sort of more concretely, more in focus, but also maybe in more detail and nuance.
Yeah, that was actually right along what I was thinking. I think I saw that where you all said that fiction works as an abstraction of life. So, yeah, which is very cool to me that we're able to do that. And I guess the follow-up question on that is, as you've done the research, is it ever noticeable that the authors of these fictional pieces kind of go in with that intent of working as in creating their pieces to not mimic, but illuminate life's, I guess, you know, less shined upon moments?
I think Keith might be able to speak about this a little bit more. He's more familiar with the work that's done on writers and their motivations and, you know, being a writer.
Yeah, all right. I mean, I think writers have got many different kinds of motivation. Some people just really want to write about themselves. And, you know, we talked about that a bit. And so there are slight transformations. But I think if we think about the some of the writers that have had the more profound impacts, then this idea of experiments is right in there. I mean, George Eliot, who is, I think, my most favorite author, I mean, she said that her writing was a set of experiments in life. And so what she was doing is exploring these possibilities. Now, as Raymond said, you can, as a reader, you can get a sense of something about the writer. But I think fiction is different from, for instance, memoir or autobiography, in that it's something that can make its own way out there in the world. So like you were saying about designing some piece of technology, this thing has to go and look after itself out there in the world and have other people engage in interactions with it. And so it's actually a piece of fiction is different from a piece of autobiography, which is of interest to people who, you know, just want to know about that particular person. A piece of fiction, if you're a writer, really you'd like it to resonate with other people's lives, not just with your own preoccupations. Now, as a writer, you do have to have the emotional engagement with it that allows you to interact with it over a long time. So you are involved in it. But as you explore this thing that you're writing, and lots of writers talk about this, takes on a life of its own. And once it starts to do that, then you know as a writer that you're getting somewhere.
There's an interesting study about fictional characters and their writers. And it describes how some writers have reported that their own fictional characters seem to get away from them and develop a life of their own. And I think it's called something about illusory autonomy. And so, you know, in some interviews, writers have mentioned that, you know, they would like a character to you know, have something happen to that character, but the character doesn't want that event to happen. And there's a bit of a dialogue or an argument or some deal making because, you know, these characters now have a life of their own. They have this illusory agency.
Ah, huh.
Deviants.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think, Lou? Yeah, that one blew my mind for a second.
So, you know, prior to digging into this, listen, did you think about the power of you in fiction more from a creator perspective or from a consumer perspective?
I thought about it more from a consumer perspective, since that's the lens, at least when I think about fictional pieces that I can, that I interact with, I'm generally the consumer, right? So everything that I do hobby-wise when it comes to literature and fiction comes from the consumer lens. You know, the podcast is from the consumer lens, all of that stuff. So yeah, so that was my aspect. How does fiction impact me as I'm reading it, reading or watching it, and I guess even listening to it when we talk about, you know, maybe like fictional podcast stories or whatever. So yeah. What about you?
It was a very passing thing to me where I thought about it, but I sort of figured I sort of knew where I was jumping in. And then that's about what it was to it. I think I got intent more than exploration, whether it was conscious or subconscious. You know, creators are communicating their vision of the world. And I was with that. Something Dr. Jamar Oatley hit on. That sort of vibes with, if you guys are Black Panther fans, know that I, Lou, have tried to watch just about everything I could find on the film. Interviews, specials, breakdowns. And something that really struck me that Ryan Coogler, my favorite director, was talking about was how he's used film to explore different concepts dating back to Fruitvale Station.
And I don't know if it's like a thing I'm conscious of, you know, in terms of bringing intimacy to it. But I would say for sure with Fruitvale, that was a goal, you know, like, cause I couldn't understand how, like, you know, I was younger than I am now. Didn't know as much about, like, the factors that went into to Oscar getting, you know, Oscar being murdered like that, and it was at a time when I it wasn't commonplace to see you know, somebody murdered by police officers on camera. Like, now with technological advancements, it is, you know what I mean? But at that time,
This is the murder of Oscar Grant, yeah, who was shot at point blank range.
Yeah, at that time it wasn't. So for me, I was like, man, I was trying to figure out how somebody could watch that videotape and not feel how I felt, you know. And I realized it was a case of intimacy, you know what I'm saying? Like when I look at him, you know, I felt closer to him than maybe somebody else did in looking at him, you know what I'm saying? And so the film was about, like, you know, let's spend time with people who knew him the best, you know, and let's spend time with him, you know what I mean? Like, and that's something that you can do through cinema, you know what I'm saying? Like, but so that was the goal there for Creed. It was, you know, similar, and a big thing for that, you know, I've been an athlete for my whole life, you know what I'm saying? So that was like a thing where, you know, getting ready for sporting events and you know, it's something that's kind of like hard to describe to people, you know, but it's something that people are familiar with as well. And like, you get like, you know, like it's funny because I was just running up on this stage with you, and I get like flashbacks, you know what I'm saying? Because it's like spotlights and it's kind of dark and people, you know, and it's like oh man, it's a trip, is kind of almost like coming out of the tunnel a little bit. I'm like an old man now, I can barely get up the stairs, and like, you know what I mean? But no, like just bringing the camera into those intimate situations that feel, you know, that feel epic, but you know, try to get the contrast and make them intimate at the same time is you know, was something that we were trying to be conscious of, and you know, the fights, you know what I'm saying, like the boxing matches, because boxing is like a, you know, it's such an intimate sport, you know, and it's a sport that's when you're truly on your own, you know, with another person that's trying to, you know, that's trying to do harm to you, you know what I mean, and it was like, okay, how do we show this, you know, how do we show this sport, how do we show this dynamic in a way that makes the audience feel like they're right there, but yet experiencing, you know, still experiencing the film. So that was something we were conscious of. With this, we tried to go about it the same way, you know. We wanted this country to feel like it was real. That was a big thing for us, and we wanted to feel like it was a country. You know what I mean? Like, because so often, you know, I've been guilty of it myself. But so often, the continent of Africa is like, it's kind of like downgraded in conversation. You know what I mean? It's talked about almost as if it's a country. Yeah. You know, and a big thing for me when I traveled there is I realized just how massive it is. You know. And how, like, it's the first place I've ever been that I feel like it's not, you can't do justice with photography, you know what I mean? Just the size of the scope of it, yeah, like, it was the first place where I was like, oh man, this place is like, man, I remember just flying over it, because I had to fly there from the UK, I flew from Heathrow, right. And I had to fly from Heathrow to Cape Town, and I remember just feeling like I was flying forever, yes, over this landmass, you know what, yeah, I'm saying? Like, I was like, man, we still over this piece of land, and it didn't match up with how, like, the images that I had, you know, seen in maps and things of that nature, you know what I mean? So, you know, a big thing for us was like, man, Wakanda can't feel like a city, it's got to feel like a country, you know, and we got to get an intimate point of view of the different aspects, of, you know, different aspects.
That's a part and an angle that I never really thought about from the creative perspective, where I'm not running this simulation to show you what I think the probable outcome is. I'm running the simulation and we're going to figure this story out as we go. And soon as I know, you'll know. Or I might not know, but putting this story out in the world will help people give me feedback on this question I presented to the world.
Yeah, that was powerful. That switched it up. For me, when I heard Coog talk about it that way.
Right. So what that got me thinking next was about how when you're in this exploration, a character might go a completely different way than you initially thought they would in the story. So, you know, while we had the good doctors on, we had to talk to them a little bit about that. Do you believe that there's a point where their initial intent diverged from the character, where the character may have reacted to something they had planned differently, and that set it different? I'm trying to figure out where the separation begins between creator.
I think that what happens is that the creator develops a character that is so rich and nuanced and detailed that all of a sudden, you can't just do whatever you want with that character because it doesn't make sense. You know, they've built up, as Keith would say, a very rich mental model of that character to the point where the model starts to, you know, behave and react to things on its own.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it used to be said that, you know, everybody has a novel inside them, and all they really need to do is to sit down and write it. And I think I'm a bit skeptical about both of those things. As a writer of novels, what I can say is writing a novel takes, you know, 4 or 5 years. And what you're doing during that time is exploring possibilities. And once a character starts to form, then it's that is making the movements into the story rather than any initial ideas you have. So in other words, as you're writing, your own ideas as a writer are changing. And, you know, the sense is that it's a character who is doing some of the guidance in that. But what I'm saying is that writing is an exploration. It's not just writing down something that is in your mind. It's not just saying, all right, this character, you do this, that, and the other. It's much more exploratory than that. And this sense of a character taking on their own life occurs when the character starts to be able to hold things together and, you know, as Raymond was saying, take on a life of her own or his own.
So I'm wondering next, the environment that character is in or the world that's built around a fictional piece, what effect does that have on the exploration that can take place for the character?
Well, that's right. I think that's the next thing to ask after what we've just been talking about. So it's not just the character, it's the character in a particular set of circumstances. And the writer is fundamentally interested in that and in a way that she or he doesn't quite understand yet. And so unlike the idea of personality in psychology, where personality is sort of more or less independent of circumstance, the idea of character in fiction is it's how a character is affected by circumstance. And so as a writer, you're saying, all right, now I'm interested in this person dealing with this circumstance. And now that's actually exploring that is what's going to be what the writer is doing. And that's why the writer is going through many, many drafts. I mean, there's lots of evidence that although some writers say they just, can sit down and write, and if some genre of fiction, you know, you can just do it very quickly because you've done it before. But most writers say they go through many drafts. And so what they're doing is they're exploring in these drafts these possible kinds of interactions between characters and circumstance.
Deviance is not tolerated.
And so there we have it, folks. It seems that writers are sort of doing an exploration where good writers are running through several drafts, where if we go back to our 100-meter experiment, it's like every single draft is another trial of the 100. And weirdly enough, I would say a writer has to have a very high level of social intelligence, because unlike a scientific experiment, you are unable to verify your results based on laws and behavior, because human social interaction, or the social interaction of intelligent beings, if you have aliens in your story, is a bit more complicated. So I think Drs. Marr and Oatley helped us cover the creator side pretty well. Now, on the consumer end, where you were thinking about it, and you go back to when you found a hashtag, what were your thoughts on how story affects the consumer, and how have they evolved since, you know, we've been working on this piece?
So I'd say the immediate response to the hashtag that I had was, yo, this is dope. This is a very, for lack of a better word, empowering hashtag that we're seeing. And the fictional pieces are, I'm a believer of the word, not a whole lot, but they're empowering these young women, and well, women in general, because, you know, most of them might be older than us now, to own who they are, right? So they were able to own who they are at whatever age that they got introduced to those fictional characters. And
And that was just, it was essentially like it was affirming, and it let them know that their experience is real. It's real enough. It's real enough that someone else in the world felt like they could imbue the characteristics, personality traits, race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, all of that stuff that makes X person who they are. They felt it was like real enough for them to put those qualities into a fictional character that would be mass produced, right? As a consumable media, a piece of media. So I was like, oh wow, that's like, that is extremely powerful. That is, there's so much weight behind that.
Yeah, and you really honed in on that more than I did, because I was sort of getting lost in the experimentation rabbit hole, and you managed to pull it back to the consumer, I guess, in relation to the creator. And we got to talk to the doctors a little bit about that relationship.
So thinking about it on the flip side of the fictional character then being put in the circumstance, and the writer exploring the many, I'll say, tree branches that this fictional character may take a path towards, to, you know, to either resolve the problem, the conflict that the circumstances may give, or obtain the goal that the circumstances provide. And flipping it to the consumer of the product, when they walk through discussions and conversations with their friends, and they kind of discuss, well, do you think, I guess in serialized pieces, how friends will say, well, I wonder why X character made this decision. It doesn't seem like that's what they would do. I think that they would have went this way. And I'm curious, is that the mind reading thing that we try to do, like draw the inferences when characters potentially make a decision or act the way that we think goes counter to what we've imagined about them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, no, I think. Sorry, Raymond.
That's absolutely the case. I think that what has occurred is that you've built up a model of that character. And then when the character behaves in a way that's inconsistent with the model that you've built up, it really tweaks you. And, you know, the model that you've built up for the character could be informed by not just what you're viewing on television or what you're reading in a book or reading in a comic book or what have you, but it's, you're probably doing a lot of filling in based upon other people that you know that are like that character, based upon maybe your own past experiences and similarities that you're seeing between yourself and that character. And I think that, you know, the reason why characters behaving in a way that seems inconsistent to us is so bothersome is because it's like a violation of our prediction system. You know, we're building up this model of the character, this rich, nuanced model of the character in order to make predictions, really. And when characters behave in ways that are inconsistent with how we believe that they should act, how our predictions are set up based upon our model, it's a little bit upsetting, you know. And characters can be written to behave in ways that are inconsistent with the model for various reasons. It could be that you hold a model of the character that's different than what the writer or creator has a model for that character. Or it could simply be that the writer has certain plot events in mind, and so certain actions need to occur, and then they're sort of compelled to have characters act in ways that you might view as sort of inconsistent with their nature or character.
Yeah, I think that's right. But then you see, I think two kinds of things can be happening. As you were saying, I mean, people now belong to reading groups. I mean, I started a reading group here in Toronto nearly, 28 years ago, and we've met ever since then, 28 years, once a month, except in the summer. And what we're doing in that reading group is we're doing what you were saying, say, oh, well, that didn't quite work for me. But then what happens, you see, is you're now looking inside yourself, and what the story has done is to enable you as a reader in conversation with your friends, as you were saying, to think around the possibilities that happen. And these may or may not be the same as what the writer had in mind. And so here's another example. You see, it's not what the people are not thinking what the writer is telling them to think. They're thinking things of their own because of their own resonances with what's going on. Another thing to say is, you know, there's a particular kind of genre called the detective story or the mystery, in which the whole thing depends on people having one interpretation at the beginning, and then as you go through it, it turns out that isn't the way the world was at all. And so rather than being upsetting, that transformation of your understanding can be rather satisfying.
So there you have it, Homicidal fans. That is about the wrap-up of our first episode of The Power of You in Fiction. But before we close out, Wilson, did you have any final thoughts?
As we've been doing the pieces now, what's come to mind is the broad scope, the high level idea of art not imitating life, but art acting as a lamp to life. So whatever the creator is doing, they're shining extra light on a particular variable within life. And that's the whole abstraction simulation part, where we have so many complexities in just this world that you can't fill that all in a story and have the story be good. So we're going to take pieces of those complexities and create this one piece of story. And that one piece of story can be shared across the world and give and introduce people to different ideas, traditions, cultures, etc. And I was like, oh, like that's mind blowing, you know. So like that, it took me for. I think what it did boilerplate it all is it took the micro and made it macro for me. I was like, oh wow, that is the big picture. That's a pretty dope big picture.
Okay, you want macro, so I'll go micro and sort of hone in on something that Dr. Mars said earlier in the episode.
In my mind, the reason why it's so prevalent is because it mirrors our fundamental interest in other people. I think that humans, as intrinsically social animals, rely upon being able to understand and collaborate and cooperate with other humans. And that turns out to be really difficult because we can't look directly into the minds of other individuals.
It hits at the core of my belief, where when I went to a Nazi story belief, and I ask people this all the time, we discuss stories, if I meet a writer, why do you think we tell stories very simply? And my answer to that question is, it's the closest thing we've got into reading each other's minds. And if we could mind drift like we were co-pilots in Pacific Rim,
right,
then we wouldn't have to verbalize how we understood each other or communicate, because not all stories are told verbally, what each right. other was thinking, and you would understand the other person. When Greg Pak was giving his pitch on Zombie with a milestone panel, and he asked the crowd who would want their wife in their brain at all times, I was the single person who raised my hand and said, yeah. And everybody else was like, no, because they imagined two separate minds functioning. And I was like, no, but if we like occupy the same space in our brain, we'd understand each other all the time. And I'm with that.
Right.
So when he was talking about that, that's something that really resonated with me. And that's why I figure we're a storyteller. where even if you're not out to answer a question, by creating these story simulations, you're letting somebody into your brain, whether you're thinking through something, whether you're communicating something straightforwardly. You cannot directly use a set of words to communicate what your brain was actually thinking. An analogy isn't always great because analogies break down rather quickly. So story allows you to do this magical thing, and fiction in particular allows you to set up your own set of rules to better explore what you wanted to explore, make the point that you're trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Well then, I hope you guys enjoyed the first episode of A Power of You in Fiction. I know we enjoyed making it, and it was a true labor of love. I guess it's like the end of Sesame Street. You gotta end, blah, blah, blah. This episode of Comicidal has been brought to you by, of course, the Comicidal crew. We'd like to thank Drs. Raymond Marr and Keith Oatley for coming and chatting with us about fiction and why we create stories.
Yes, they were a fantastic guest, and Dr. Marr is a professor at York University in Canada, and Dr. Oatley is a professor emeritus at the University of Toronto.
Shout out Deviant for composing our theme music. Find him on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/nodeviants, on Twitter at nodeviants, or on Facebook at Deviant Beats. That's my mentee, and I'm proud to call him the homie. Congratulations, you just scored a podcast. For other musical credits, for the music used during the race experiment example, go check out the movie Race about Jesse Owens. That's from The Final Race. And the music behind Coog's dialogue was the closing credits from the Creed film. So check those out. As always, if you got any questions, if this inspired you to think, if you liked the episode, email us at podcast@comicidal.net. Tweet us, hit us up on Instagram, both at Comicidal T-Hawks. Interact. We want to hear from you. We want to talk to people and get outside of our own heads and bubbles, because the more Wilson and I podcast together, the more we mental drift when we get on mic. And so we love the difference of opinion. Hit us up.
Some stuff that we can tackle and do better and come at it from a different angle. That's how we grow. By constant discomfort. So, you know what I mean? Poke us a little bit.
If we said some crap you felt was wild, let us know. We can talk about that too. The discourse is what we love here at Comicidal. Today's closing quote will be read by Kia Presley, who is an unseasonably warm day at the end of a persistent and cruel winter.
Every story I create creates me. I write to create myself. Octavia Butler.
So, this is Lou.
And Wilson.
This is the Comicidal Podcast, where our goal is to bring you all a higher class of comic analysis, and we hope you keep rocking with us.